Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, last week we started with the sixth chapter. We discussed the Perek Vav in the Megillah. Brief summary was basically where the king cannot sleep. That's where we picked up from the story. We described the obvious reasons why the king would not be able to sleep. He's got major concerns on his mind. He's got Esther inviting Haman to this party, this otherwise intimate gathering between the king and the queen, and Haman seems to be a part in it. We had the explanation of the Vilna Gaon, that he was concerned that they were clearly going to ask for it. We either have to understand it as he was concerned that there was something going on between Esther and Haman, or he was concerned that the two of them were going to tag up against him to ask for some major request for Mordechai. So he's got something on his mind, trying to figure out what's going on. He can't sleep. He calls for the book. He finds out what Mordechai did. And meanwhile, at the same time, Haman is, of course, obsessing with killing Mordechai. He can't handle the fact that Mordechai is around. And as we went through the story last week, ends up, of course, leading him through the town. And the wife says to him, if you already see that you're falling apart in front of the Jews, you could forget about it. All things are going to be lost. The Jews don't have any type of mazel. They're above and beyond the stars. And that's where we basically left off last week. So if that made sense to you, it's because you were here last week. If that didn't make sense to you, check it out online. It's fine. You don't need it for tonight. That's just to get us back into the flow. So what we started last week, we began the beginning of the seventh chapter. Let's just quickly begin that as well this evening. Just to read the first couple verses in English to get back into the flow. The king and Haman came to a feast with Queen Esther. I'm at page 1258 in your art scroll, Chumash, 1258, beginning of the seventh chapter in those red books. What's that? Page 38 and 39, seventh chapter. So the king and Haman come to a feast with Queen Esther. This is the second party. They've gone through the whole episode of the previous day already. And he asks her again, what is your request, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. What is your petition? Even if it is up to half the kingdom, it shall be fulfilled. Now this is the second time that the king has made this request of Esther. This is the second time in which he's basically said to her, whatever you want, name it, it's yours. I will grant you the request that you seek if you just ask me. This is the second time that he has now done that. It's actually the third time, I should correct myself, because the first time that he does it is the first time that Esther comes in the very first night when she barges in and he says, whatever you want. And what does she ask for then? A party. They have the party the first day and he asks now a second time, whatever you want, half the kingdom, ask me, I'll give it to you. And what does she ask for? Second party. So this is now the third time he's asking, whatever you want, and I will give it to you. Now there's a very obvious question which all of you have had for years and years and years, I'm sure, when you read the Megillah. Very obvious question. So obvious, in fact, that you've probably already heard some sort of answer to it, and you've always assumed that answer when you read the Megillah every year, because the question is so powerful. And that question is, you're the queen. You barge into the king, and the king extends his scepter to you, and he says to you, my queen, I will grant you anything. It's yours. Ask me. I'll give you. What should you ask for? Very simply, you should say, king, your royal highness, there's been some mistake, some type of bureaucratic mix-up somewhere at my people. You see, there's been this decree. Just sign this paper here. Just put your signature right here. We'll send it out. End of the story. We'll do dinner. It'll be great. Thank you very much. That's all she has to say. He's asked her for whatever you want. I'll give it to you. And she doesn't do that. She doesn't do it the first time he asks. And if you'll say that she was nervous because she wasn't sure if she was going to survive the whole ordeal, she doesn't do it the second time he asks, a second party. And now it's the third time, and this question has to be addressed. How come she doesn't just come straight out and say, just sign this paper right here, I'll have the document written up before I walk in, all you got to do, put your name on the bottom here, we'll repeal the decree, we'll send out some letters, everything will be fine, forget about the whole incident, I understand, things happen, mistakes, it's okay, not a problem, don't worry about it. She doesn't do that. So now it's the third time, we're finally getting to the climax of the story, the third time he has asked her, and now she says as follows, and we began this last week as well. Vatan Esther Amalko Vatoimar. She answers and she says, Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, Yimatsasi Chein Veinecha HaMelech, if I have found favor and it pleases the Melech, Tinasein Li Nafshi B'She'elasi Ve'ami B'Vakashasi. She makes two requests, two things she says in this. My life be granted to me as my request, meaning to say, my life is in danger, and my people as my petition. My life and my people. She's asking for two things, two problems that I have, Your Highness. Two problems, my life and my people. What should be going through the king's mind when he hears this? Right? Two things should be going through his mind. Your life is in danger? Like, we've been having all these parties. I mean, you've come in, things seem to be pretty nice. Like, you came in, you asked me, I said, what do you want? I'll give you anything. And you said, a tea party. All right. And then you came in, and I said, what do you want? I'll give you anything. And you said, let's have another tea party. And now you come in and you say, my life is at stake. Where are you coming from? And then she says, and my people. And what's the king thinking? What people? How long have Esther and Achashverosh been married at this point? Anyone know? 5 years. In the third year, this is quick history, in the third year of the king's reign is the very third verse of the Megillah. In his third reign, he throws a big party for all of the provinces. In the seventh year, Esther is crowned, which means it took 4 years from the time that Vashti was killed until the king tried out all the young ladies in the provinces. 4 years go by before Esther is finally crowned. We are now, as we'll see in the Megillah, in the 12th year of the king's reign. They've been married 5 years. 5 years, the king says to her, so where are you from? And she says, no idea. I don't have any people. My mother died, my father died, and this guy Mordechai has raised me. He clearly had a relationship with Mordechai. That the king knew, everybody knew. And she's been saying, but that's not my people. I don't know. I don't have a people. So I'm a nobody. 5 years she's saying this. All of a sudden at the second tea party, she says to him, my life is at stake and my people's life is at stake. And the king has got to be thinking, what are you talking about? What is this? Now, keep that in mind as we move forward. And she explains, had we only been sold as slaves, I wouldn't have said anything. But since we're going to be destroyed, I have to do something. Now, we mentioned last week the language that she said, if we only would have been sold, hecharashti, I would have remained silent. And she's paralleling the language that Mordechai had said to her, im hacharesh tacharishi, if you'll remain silent at this moment, you'll be lost. And she's saying to the king now, had we only been sold as slaves, I would have remained silent, but here I can't. And we mentioned last week that the Mordechai's language was really paralleling from the Chumash in Parshas Matos about vows, where the Torah says that if a young husband hears his wife's vow and he is tacharesh tacharish, that same language, he is silent on her vow, then it takes hold and he's held accountable for remaining silent when he had the ability to annul it and he didn't. He's accountable for it. So Mordechai was paralleling that language to Esther, and she now says, I would have remained silent, but I can't because my people's life is at stake. I have to step in. And then the last line of this paragraph, Ki ein hatsar shoyve benezek hamelach. I would have kept quiet if we were only sold as slaves, because it's not worth the king's being involved in it. And that word shove, again, Esther is paralleling two other places in the Megillah we have that language. Where are the other two places we have that word? Haman says what? One place he says when he can't stand that Mordechai is not bowing down, he says, Kol ze einenu shoveli. It's not worth it to me. All this honor, all this glory, it's not worth it to me when I see Mordechai. Where's the other place? When Haman comes to the king and suggests that he should wipe out this nation, this unnamed nation, he says, they don't listen to your laws, they're dispersed. Ein shoyve lamelech lahanicham. It's not worth it for the king to keep them around. So that same language that Haman used in destroying the Jews is the same language that he uses when he can't tolerate Mordechai. And now Esther uses it in saying to the king, it otherwise would not have been worth your while, but since we're going to be exterminated, I do have to get myself involved. Okay, so now she's finished her speech. She's finally said her piece after these two episodes. Now, why do you think she didn't want to say this right away? Why is she waiting? Why is she holding off on just coming out and saying what it is that's bothering her? So I want to share with you a thought that Rabbi David Foreman suggested as to what's really going on here. Do you think the king liked, disliked, or was parv, neutral, about the fact that Esther didn't have a place? Was that something to him which was, like, whatever, makes no difference? Was a negative or was a positive when he was weighing the options and he sees this girl Esther?
I think it's kind of embarrassing for the king to be married to a nobody.
Okay, that's one aspect. Now you're actually rooted that Rashi learns the reason why Mordechai didn't want to say who she was that she should be looked upon as a nobody. She shouldn't have. She actually was descended from King Saul, from Shaul HaMelech. So he didn't want anybody to know that because then the king would want her. So that is a fair thought. Yeah.
Well, the other thing was you were talking last week about Queen Vashti being above Ahasuerus because he was low-born, if you will.
Right.
And she came from royalty. I don't think he wanted to start with that again.
So he wanted somebody.
I need this aggravation twice.
So Rabbi Foreman has this fascinating approach. He says as follows. The Megillah, in the very beginning of the Megillah, the first eight verses are rather odd in the Megillah. Now, we're all familiar with those eight verses. What goes on in the first eight verses of the Megillah?
The party,
right? How many verses would you spend on the party? A sentence? In the third year of the king's reign, he made a party. Vashti didn't want to come. He has her killed. Let's go on. Right, this is a long Megillah. Eight full verses. What do the eight verses describe? Right, look. We talk about silver rods, marble pillars, couches of gold and of silver, pavement green with shell. Why is this? What kind of book is this? Is this a book about Persian wealth and honor? Like, why is it relevant to us that we spend so much time describing this party? Says Rabbi Foreman, it must be relevant. I'm going to hold back on the question because we've a lot to cover and I want to keep focused. Says Rabbi Foreman, it must be relevant. Why is it relevant? Why would the king throw such a lavish party? We need to know about all the details. If you were the king of 127 provinces and you're in 3rd century Persia, without email, no cell phones, you don't even have a fax machine. I mean, not even a fax machine do you have. Nothing. What is your greatest concern? You are ruling over an empire from India to Ethiopia. What is your greatest concern? Keeping this together. Communication, control. I mean, I got a big area here, and they're not going to see me often or hear from me often. It's enormous. How do you control such an enormous area from your central location? Says King Ahasuerush, no problem. We're going to throw a big party. Huge. 180-day party. And we're going to bring all the dignitaries from all the lands, and they're going to feast. And they're going to go home, and they're going to say, that King Ahasuerush, he's got it going, man. That was awesome. 180 days, we partied, we like him, we're on board, he's powerful, he's wealthy, and he's good to us. And he creates a central party, and everybody is there. Anybody who's anybody comes, takes part, and he now has a way of gaining and garnering his control from this party, because he's going to be the central location. Rabbi Foreman suggests that Esther saying, I don't have a place, is actually a tremendous mila, tremendous benefit, because she's not provincial anymore. He's trying to establish a kingdom that's everyone's kingdom. I am the central location of a huge empire. How much greater is it for him to have a queen who is not identified as, you know, this area, or that area, or from here, or from there. She's just Persia's queen. She's all of ours. She doesn't have a place to say, this is my group. There are 127 different provinces, different states, different areas, different customs. And she's not any one of theirs. She's all of ours. And the new queen taking over the king, following his big party, trying to establish this. Now you gotta remember, he's going now 4 years between years 3 and year 7. He doesn't have any queen. And his new queen is gonna now fill that role and be our queen. Rabbi Foreman suggests as a possibility, when she needs to come in and save her people, she's actually got a very big liability going against her. She's been living this lie, this 5-year lie of I don't have a people, and it's actually played up to her benefit. It's part of a program of sorts. And now she's going to walk in, and Mordechai says to her, you got to step in for our behalf. And she's not so, she's got to figure out how to do this. So she doesn't just come in, but she sets up this situation. Now she's got a triangle going on with Haman. Let's have Haman involved. He's really the source, but Ahasuerus doesn't know that Haman has against the Jews, because he doesn't know who the people are that are being destroyed. So she has to figure out a plot to somehow figure this out, but she doesn't come straight up or straight out and say, these are my people, I care about them a lot, and I've been living a lie for the last 5 years. Doesn't quite paint her in the greatest of light. What happened to the previous queen who tried to pull some type of shenanigans against the king? Didn't work out so well for her. So there's this, she's up against this as she comes in and has to step in to save her people. So now she's finally said it. She just told the king, my life is in danger, and my people are in danger. The king's reaction has got to be, on both accounts, what are you talking about? Your life is in danger in the palace, right here, under my nose? We're having all these tea parties, and you're afraid for your life from who? And your people? What people? What people are you talking about? So, she said her piece. What's the king's response? Let's look at his response. Now, the English in Pasuk Hay is answering a difficulty in the text, in the way that they translate this. I don't know how the red book, I only have the stone chumash. But let's read the Hebrew, and I will translate it literally for you. Tell me what's odd about this pasuk. Vayomer hamelech Achashverosh, and King Achashverosh said, Vayomer le'Esther hamalka, and he said to Esther the queen, Mihu zeh ve'ezehu asher mila'o libo la'asos kein. No, let's leave Mihu zeh ve'ezehu outside. Who, basically, who is this who's trying to do this? What's odd about this pasuk?
Vayomer twice.
Right? He says Vayomer twice. Vayomer Hamelach Achashverosh. And the king said, Vayomer le'Esther Hamalka. What do you mean? He's in the middle of talking. You just said, Vayomer Melech Achashverosh. Normally what follows in the pasuk is what he said. And here we have it twice. Vayomer Hamelach Achashverosh, Vayomer le'Esther Hamalka. Well, if the second time he's speaking to Esther. Now the art school here, they're trying to avoid it. How does the art school translate this? He exclaimed and said. If you were just reading the English, you wouldn't notice something terribly odd about that. They're trying to avoid that problem, so they translate the double language as he exclaimed and said. But when you read the Hebrew, it's he said and he said, twice, consecutively, without saying anything the first time. So a couple of the commentators, the Vilna Gaon amongst them, I saw this somewhere else as well. The first time, he actually asked this question twice. When you find something out, you're the king, and you just found out something massive going on in your kingdom, and you have nothing, you don't know anything about it. Your very queen is claiming her life is in danger, her people being destroyed, and you're clearly lost because you don't know what she's talking about. Who's the first person you ask? Your second in command. Says the Vilna Gaon, Vayomer Hamelech Achashverosh, he says to Haman, Haman, what's she talking about? Not knowing that Haman's the one who did the whole thing, but he's the second in command. So when you're the king and you just found out that there's like something big going on under your nose, you know, so you say to your second in command, what's she talking about? What does Haman say? Nothing. What does he got to say? He's stuck. So the pasuk says, Vayomer le'Esther Hamalka. So the king turns to Haman and he says, what's she talking about? Haman's got nothing to say. So he turns to Esther and asks the same question a second time, what's going on? What are you talking about? That's how the Vilna Gaon understands the two Vayomers over here. First, he's questioning Haman, what's going on? But Haman doesn't have much to say at this point. He sees that things are not going quite the way that he sees. He doesn't have anything to say. So then he turns to Esther and he says, Mihu zeh ve'ezehu. Now that's a phrase we're all familiar with. Mihu zeh ve'ezehu. What does that mean? What are these two questions? Mizehu ve'ezehu. So Art Scroll again here will translate it, which is based on some of the commentators, as who is it? And where is he? Now, Ezehu doesn't literally mean, that second phrase literally in a vacuum, Ezehu would mean, who is it? Again, it's another question of Ezeh, like what is it or who is it? It's as if he's asking the same question twice. Who is it? And who is it? Says the Vilna Gaon, why is he asking twice, who is it?
So he wants to know who her people are.
Exactly. Mi hu zeh is asking, you just said your life is at stake. You're about to be killed, and I don't know what you're talking about because we're having tea parties and you're in the palace. Mi hu zeh, what are you talking about? Who's threatening your life? The Ezehu says the Vilna Gaon is, people? You have a people, my dear Queen Esther? What are you talking about? Two questions. Mi hu zeh, Ezehu, says Esther. Now, if you're Esther at this point in the story, are you in a good position or a weak position? Where is she standing right now?
Weak.
I would say she's fairly weak because she's just exposed herself to a tremendous lie. She doesn't seem to be in any danger. I mean, things around the palace seem to be pretty normal. We're having all these tea parties. She's claiming her life's in danger, and she's just revealing not only has she been lying to him for the last 5 years, but the people whom she's been lying about, she cares about deeply. And she's willing to risk her life for them because 2 days earlier, she barged into his inner chamber, which everybody knows when you do that, it's a death sentence. And she was willing to do that for these people whom she's been hiding for all of these years. So she's not exactly in the strongest of positions when she reveals to Ahasuerus this thing of, my people are at stake. And he asks her, who's putting you at stake? And Ve'ezo, and who are these people that you're talking about? Says Esther, Pasuk Vav 6, Vatoimer Esther, Ish, Tsar the Oyev. So before describing who it is, she says, a person, an adversary, and an enemy. Haman hara hazeh. This evil man, Haman. Now, we don't call him a Rasha, we call him hara. One of the commentators I saw points out the difference between calling him a Rasha and a Ra. Ra, which is the word that she uses, defines an inner essence of evil. The difference between evil, the two levels of evil. Sometimes people are evil when they have personal gain out of it. Like you gain something from it, so you do something bad. But there's like we can at least justify, we can understand why you're doing it. It's bad what you're doing. It's wrong, but at least we could understand it. Ra is where you don't even have a personal gain from it, but you want to do it anyway. That's when you know you're talking, you've crossed the line just from badness into evil, when it's just like, what are you gaining from it? What is Haman gaining by wiping out this entire nation? He doesn't get anything. In fact, he paid 10,000 coins in order to be able to do it. Where's his benefit? So says Esther, Haman hara hazeh, v'haman nivas milifnei hamelech v'hamalka. Now Haman becomes filled with a trembling and terror before the king and the queen. Now, if you were Haman and you had the queen in front of you, just the Queen Esther, what argument, what would you say to the queen at this point? Let's just say it was just you and the queen. What argument would you make to the queen?
I'm wrong.
No.
I didn't mean you.
Who knew? You? Esther? A Jew in the palace? All these years you've been lying? I didn't know. Would never have guessed. Wouldn't have done it. Now, he can go a couple of different ways, but if it's just this issue, he could probably make an argument that would turn this on her head, that she's been lying this whole time. Who would have, I never would have done it had I known, but you didn't tell me, so who knew? I'll protect you, we'll make a deal, you and your family come to the palace, we'll protect you, but the rest of these people, he would have something to say to her in that sense of, who knew, I didn't mean it, I wouldn't know. If he was arguing just to the king, he would have said, listen, we'll protect Esther, but these people, as I told you already, they're horrible. They're wicked. They're a bunch of no-goodniks. They don't listen to your laws. They don't abide. They keep their own things. They're dispersed. As I argued to you before, they're bad, so they're still bad. Okay, so we'll spare the queen, but the people, they're no good for us. But between the two of them together, when the king and the queen are standing there together, he can't really make either one of these arguments. He can't make the argument that the people are inherently bad anyway, because Esther's still sitting there, and these are her people. And to start playing up the queen against the king in front of the queen, he's in front of the two of them, he doesn't really have much of an argument to say at this point, so he begins to tremble. Now, you're the king, and you just hear this. You just heard this. You're second in command. Like, think about where you're coming from. You're in the middle of this party. Everything is going well. Second party with the queen, with Haman. You're suspicious a little bit of Haman. You're not really sure what he's doing there. And all of a sudden, the queen lets out that this guy, your second in command, is trying to kill her. which he clearly, Haman himself didn't know anything about, but he's trying to kill her and her people. You didn't know that she had a people. What are all the things going through the king's mind right now? So he's, on the one hand, he's got to figure out that like his wife's been lying to him for the last 5 years. Not sure what to do with that. On the other hand, his wife's claiming that her life is in danger, and that Haman, his second in command, is now trying to kill his wife. Now, if you remember that part of his suspicion was that Haman was involved in some type of love triangle with his wife, so it's a variation of that. He's not trying to take Esther away from him through some type of relationship, but he's still trying to take her away from him, but now it's more in a sense of he's trying to kill her. So there are a lot of different things going through the king's mind right now, both in the sense of Haman trying to kill Esther, trying to kill all these people, it's her people, I don't know if she had a people. So what does the king do? So he gets up to take a walk. Why does he get up to take a walk? Well, probably because he's got a lot to like sift through as far as what's his next move. Is his next move against Haman? What's the other possibility? Next move against her. So he's So he gets up and he takes a walk. Now Esther was probably not hoping for that. She was probably hoping for some swift movement against Haman after her speech that she's in danger and it's this guy right here. He's wicked and he's evil and he's trying to knock out my people. But the king doesn't do that. And the fact that he doesn't do that is probably in her, probably not in her best interest that he's going out to start to think about all the things that he just heard at this little party. Now that he's gone, what does Haman do? He begins to plead his case before Esther. When Esther's alone, what do we think he's saying to her? And he's probably making an argument of, listen, we can smooth this out. I had no idea that you were a Jewess. I don't want to get you into trouble. We'll make a deal. We'll protect some of your family. We'll figure out something. He's pleading his case before Esther. So the Megillah says, let's read it inside. Hamelach has come b'chamasam yimishteh. In his anger, he gets up from the table, the party. Now again, let's note, this is the other place. We mentioned last week how many times the language of chema, of anger, is used in the Megillah. And we mentioned that there are two types of angers. There is when Achashverosh got angry at Vashti, it said two languages. Vayik tzof hamelach mod, he got very angry. Vachamaso ba'arobo, and his anger burned within him. The two types of anger, there's the outer external anger, I asked you something and you didn't listen to me. And then there's the inner anger, which is a much more unexpressed, internal, I'm embarrassed if anybody would know that I'm really angry about this, but I am, type of anger. That's the anger that Haman has at Mordechai. It's not just an external anger, it's burning within him. And that's a lot of times when there's an external anger, there's something else which is burning within. And that's the language we use here also. He's angry. Why is he so angry right now, the king? Well, he's got a lot of things going on. He's got Haman trying to take his queen away, killing all these people. He's got this Esther issue, like, you've been lying to me all these years. He gets up from the table, and Haman so he's pleading his case, pleading for his life from before Esther, because he saw that the king clearly was angry at him. So on some level, that's clear. The Megillah says Haman saw that the king was angry at him. Now, beginning of verse 8, one of the great mysteries of one of the great mysteries in all of the Megillah. I love this next thought, which I first came across this year as I was preparing this class. Hamelach shav miginas habisan al beis mishteh ayayin. The king returns. What was the king's next move going to be? You have no idea. What would he have said? What would he have come back with? Would he have come back with something against Haman? Something against Esther? Something against both of them? No idea. Because what does the king find when he returns? Haman has made a slight mistake because Esther and the way that they used to sit in their parties are on couches. And Esther is lying down on a couch. And Haman is noifel al hamita. He's falling over the couch. Poshet pshat in his trembling and his realizing that his life is in danger. He can't keep himself to stand straight. The Medrash, as many of us are familiar with, says that a maluch kept giving a little push from behind, making him fall over. But be it as it may, he's literally over her on the couch. And the king returns, and we're waiting. If we were watching a movie, like, what's he going to come back with? He's got a lot going through his mind. He took a walk. Here's the moment he comes back, and before he's able to say anything that he would have said. Instead, what he sees is Haman's now falling over his wife on the couch, and what blurts out of his mouth is not whatever he was planning on saying. The first words out of his mouth, says the Megillah, Hagam lichboish es hamalcha imi bebayis, are you trying to conquer the queen in my own home? Now that's clearly not what he had planned on saying. He didn't come back from his walk in the garden with that line in mind. And we don't know what exactly he was going to say. It would seem from the Megillah, it would seem a little bit, I don't know how much it would seem, the fact that Haman is falling over and that's what directs his attention is unclear exactly where he would have gone otherwise. But that's where he ends up when he walks back and he sees Haman falling is Hagam lich boish es hamalka. That's all he has to say upon his return from his walk, seeing Haman on top of his wife, trying to kill his wife. He started the day suspicious that something was going on with him and his wife. Now that's what he sees. That's the end. And when Haman hears that, then he knows it's all finished. As the pasuk said before, that Haman already saw he was angry at her. So there's no question that he's angry at Haman. The question really is, what would have happened to Esther? Would she have been left unscathed from his anger or not? So that we don't know what he would have said. But when he comes back and he sees Haman in that position, it's totally directed against Haman, and that's the end of the story. So now Haman is finished. Pasuk Tes 9, Charvona, who was one of the earlier chamberlains that we come across in the beginning, in the first chapter, says before the king, guess what? Not only that, but Haman had made these gallows in which he planned and intended on hanging Mordechai, and Mordechai was the one who we just had parading through town this very day because he was the one who saved your life before. So the king says, if that's the case, we got to get rid of him. Vayislu es Haman al ha'etz asher echin leMordechai. They hang Haman on the gallows which he had prepared for Mordechai. Vachamas hamelech shachach. And the king's anger is abated. That's the end. All of this build up, this climax of the story, all of these parties, and it's finally now come down to this, in which the king's anger is now abated after all of this. And you take, as you're reading this in the story, you take a deep breath. Like, what a story. I mean, until this point, it's just filled with subplots and different things going on, and it climaxes in this whole story, and now Haman is finished, and the king's anger is finished. It's diffused. V'chamas ha'melech shachacha. Now, if you've ever been through a Megillah reading before, and I know that all of you have, so there's a certain problem that we get at this point in the story. At this point in the story, we all take that deep breath and we say, ah, finished. Start getting your coat ready. Time to go home. Haman is gone. He's killed. Everything is going to be great for the Jews. What's the problem? There's only three chapters left. Like, you're like, the Megillah's too long. Like, and like, at this point is when you start flipping pages, like, it's been great, it's a compelling story, everything is awesome. Now at the climax, I'm like, why are we still reading horsemen here and horsemen there, they're running here, messages, wars, day, like, so many, why, so long, this is the story, right, we just finished it, we got home and he's done, he's dead, he's dying, all is good. And there's still something going on over here. So I'll share with you something that is strikingly odd. Let's read the next couple of verses of the eighth chapter. Now, as a person who reads the Megillah, it's, you know, the minhag that we have, the beautiful minhag of when you hear the name Haman, so we bang on the table. So as a reader, it's very choppy. You know, you're trying to read and you remember, because when you're at home practicing, there's nobody there banging on the table as you read. So you sort of have a flow of the Megillah and it's always disrupted by the reading. And when I get to this point, I was like, ah, we're finished with Haman. But we still have all of these references. We're still going to have it's like, it's not over the Megillah, which we should be done at this point. And we keep going. Let's read the next three or four verses. So that very day, King Ahasuerush gave the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. So now we have his whole estate. This is a powerful person, Haman. He's a wealthy individual, the second in command. So Ahasuerus takes his estate and he gives it to Esther. And Mordechai now presents himself to the king because Esther revealed his relationship to her. That she was really her uncle. And as the sages say, they were actually married to each other. I'm not sure if they actually revealed that or not. That would be a little bit of an oddity. But the simple meaning of the text was that they were an aunt and an uncle and a niece, and that was revealed to the king because now she had blown her cover. This queen, this universal queen, has now become the queen of the Jews. And the king slipped off his signet ring, which he had removed from Haman, and gave it to Mordechai, and Esther put Mordechai in charge of Haman's estate. And everything is great. They've now taken over the wealthiest, second to wealthiest man in the entire empire, and it's all in their hands. Things are good for the Jews or bad for the Jews? What's that?
Not yet.
Not yet?
Good. Not clear.
Not clear. Well, we'd like to think they should be good. Haman's gone. We're in charge of his estate. And Esther does an odd thing now. Vatosef Esther. Esther yet again, again approaches the king, collapses at his feet, cries, and begs him to avert the evil intention of Haman the Agagite. Esther, at this point, falls before his feet, cries, and pleads before him. This is the first time that she's done so. First time that she's cried, first time that she's pleaded, first time that she falls before his feet. Say, wait, but we're in the eighth chapter now. Haman's dead. Now she's falling before his feet? Now she's crying? Why now? This is what her response should have been the first time she came into his chamber, the second time, the third time, but at this point already, he's a dead man. Haman's gone. He's out of the picture. We have his whole estate. It's been given to Mordechai. And now she gives the reaction that we actually would have expected her to have had well before this. Why is she first reacting this way now? So this is the way of the Yosef Lekach, one of the classic commentators. Zvi Le-Goyen actually bases a lot of his commentary on this commentary, which preceded him, says as follows. If I make a major request to someone, let's say I make a request for my boss for a raise, and I have a specific request. There's a specific type of raise that I want and the way that I want it structured or the type of benefits that I want. And my boss listens to my request and he comes back to me and I requested an extra, let's say I requested an extra week of vacation and healthcare benefits. And he comes back to me and he says, just wanted you to know we really appreciate what you're doing. What we're going to do is we're going to offer your children free preschool care in our preschool, and we'll give you a raise of whatever extra money that I some amount of money.
Hypothetically
speaking. So I walk out of there and I say, well, that's odd. I asked for an extra week of vacation and healthcare benefits, and he gave me a raise in money and free preschool. What do I think he's going to do with the things that I actually wanted? Right? There's a big no, because if I make a request and I have specific things and he comes back and he gives me things but not the things that I wanted, so then I have good reason to believe that the things that I actually am concerned with, he's declining. He's saying no to me, but I happen to like you, so I'll give you this. But the things that you wanted, the answer is no. So, V'chamos HaMelech Shachacha, the end of the seventh chapter concluded, the king's anger abated. He was done. He finally diffused that and things calmed down. And what does he give to Esther? The house of Haman. What was Esther's concern when she walked in the beginning of the second part? She says, my life is at stake and my people are at stake. And the king says, here's a lot of money. Here's Haman's estate. And that's it. And then he finishes talking. And he gives her the ring. You're in charge of the thing. It's all yours. And have a nice day. And now Esther falls at his feet. And now she begins to cry. And she begins to plead. And she begins to say, but your king, my king, if the story ends now, my people die. Like, yeah, the story ended in chapter 7 with Haman's being finished. But what do all 127 provinces still have in their hands? They have a decree that was sent out that says on the 13th of Adar, 11 months from now, we're going to annihilate all the Jews. Says the queen, pleading before the king, I don't want Haman's house. I got a problem on my hands. We're all dead if the story ends right now. And now she begins to plead and to beg and to cry before him. You have to revoke this decree. Now, does the king actually do that or not?
No.
The king doesn't do it. What does the king say?
You can go to war.
What's that?
You can go to war.
He doesn't even say that. What does the king say?
Something that was signed by the king.
I can't do anything about it. Sorry. Rules are rules, Esther, you know that. Rules of the 127 provinces are, once something's been signed by the king and sent out, sorry, nothing that I can do. But you know what, you have that ring, so you could really do whatever you want at this point. You want to send something out, you can do that, but I can't really help you. And it's fascinating, at the end of this, the king doesn't actually listen to the request as far as what the story that we're told is. He says, I can't do anything about it. But you have Haman's ring, you want to send something out, you can do whatever you want. Unclear whether or not the king, in his wildest dreams, would have imagined that what Mordechai would have done would have been to send out a second set of letters saying that the Jews should actually fight back first. I don't know whether he would have expected that or would not have expected it. Just from the text itself, and the Megillah as we have it, it's interesting how it actually plays out from here, from this point on. But what I do want to share with you, we'll see if we can get to some another thought. I won't say a final thought. We'll see how the timing goes. Let's look at Esther's actual plea that she makes when she falls before him and she begs and she cries in front of Ahasuerus. Vatayomer, verse starting in Pasuk Hey, verse 5. Vatayomer imal haMelech toiv v'matzasi chein lefanav. If it's good for the king and I found favor, v'kosher adavar lefnei haMelech, and it's proper in the eyes of the king. So she asks him to repeal the decree, which he is eventually not going to listen to. He will not do it. Which Haman has sent out, which he wrote to destroy all the Jews. And then she says as follows in verse 6, and this is one of the various psukim which are read with the tune from Eicha, the Tisha B'Av tune, Ki Eicha cha uchal v'ra'isi, for how can I bear to witness the disaster which will befall my people? How can I bear to witness the destruction of my relative? I can't bear to see it. So she pleads and begs before him. Extra credit. Where else have we seen this phrase? How can it be, she says, that I will see the evil which will befall my nation. This is a takeoff of a phrase which we've seen before. And so there's a very similar language to this.
Yonah?
Nope. I'll give you a hint. It's in your book. So somewhere in the Chumash. Not in Tanakh. Take a look. If you have a stone Chumash in front of this, I apologize for those who don't have the stone actual Chumash. I'll read it inside. If you flip to page 252, the very beginning of Parshas Vayigash. Parshas Vayigash finds us where Yosef is in the second in command of all of Mitzrayim, and the brothers have been before him already the second time, and he's taken Binyamin, his brother, captive, because the cup has been found in Binyamin's sack, and the brothers come back to approach him. And who leads the charge? Yehuda. Why Yehuda? Because Yehuda says, I have put my life on the line. I have promised my father, our father, Yaakov, that I will bring back Binyamin safely, and therefore he pleads his case that let me stay behind, but you have to set this young boy, this Binyamin, free. And he makes his argument. In verse 34, on page 252, Yehuda says, Ki eich e'ela el avi v'hanar einene iti. How can I go back to my father, and this young boy will not be with me? Pen era v'ro asher yimtso es avi, lest I see the evil which will befall my father. Listen to his words. Pen era, I will see v'ro asher yimtso es avi. Esther says, v'ro'isi v'ro asher yimtso es ami. The exact same phrase, lest I see the evil. Yehuda said the phrase, lest I see the evil which will befall my father. And Esther says that exact same phrase, lest I see the evil which will befall my people. Paralleling the same language that Yehuda said to Yosef. Now put yourself in Yehuda's position. Yehuda says an amazing thing when he speaks to Yosef. Yehuda says, and if you have your finger on the place on page 250, he makes his plea to Yosef and he says, Vayomer avdecho avi eleinu. Yehuda speaking there says, our father said to us, Atem yedatem kishnayim yol deli ishti. You know that my wife had only two children. And one is gone, and this is the only one that I have left, referring to Binyamin. And you're Yehuda, and you hear your father say that. You know that my wife had only two children. What are you thinking if you're Yehuda?
You're right.
Remember chopped liver? I mean, you know that my wife only had two children. And yet, Yehuda says these words over to Yosef, and he says, I promised my father I would bring him back. My father said to us that my wife had two children, Yosef and Binyamin, and I, the son of another wife, who's not getting the same type of recognition right now, have put myself on the line. I'm going to bring him back. I'm not going to protect ourselves. We're not going to just let them go, but we are going to put ourselves, and we're going to risk our own lives because we're going to bring him back. Rabbi Foreman points out here also a very interesting thing. Which two tribes were exiled at this point to Babylonia, Persia, which we are right now? It's Yehuda and Binyamin. The other 10 tribes had already been exiled several years before. They eventually got lost. Today we don't know where they are. But in this area of Babylon, these two tribes are the Yehuda and Binyamin. Now, how are the Jews referred to throughout the Megillah? Yehudim. That's clear. Throughout the Megillah, they're referred to as Yehudim. And Yehudim is clearly a term which refers to the Jews. Who are the Jews actually comprised of? The tribes of Yehuda and Binyamin. There probably were some others mixed in there, but primarily Yehuda and Binyamin. And they now have this generic term, Yehudim, which came from the tribe of Yehuda, but it's now referring to all of them. Now, this is the first exile of the Jewish people. We're in the middle of the first exile. It's within 70 years that the first temple was destroyed. The Jews are now in exile. They're, after this story, will eventually go back. When they were in the land of Israel, they were clearly tribal. There were the 12 tribes, and each tribe identified with their tribe. We have numerous stories throughout Tanakh, which clearly had them identifying as a tribe. We had civil wars, all sorts of problems, but they had their own tribes, their own leaders. They were clearly one nation, and during different parts of our histories, we had problems, the Northern Kingdom, the Southern Kingdom. And now we have all of these Jews are just grouped together as Yehudim. Which tribe did Esther come from? Binyamin. She was descended from Shaul HaMelech. She was a Benjamite. Which tribe did Mordechai come from? Binyamin. Ish Yehudi, a Jew, but he was an Ish Yemini. He was from the tribe of Binyamin. So here you have in the palace Esther and Mordechai, descended from the tribe of Binyamin, and the Jews, the majority of whom were from the tribe of Yehuda, from Shevet Yehuda, are in trouble still. And Esther says, in the same way that Yehuda, the exact same words that Yehuda says, Eich ereh bara'ah asher yimtso esavi, how can I sit by Italy by and see what's going to happen to my brother Binyamin from the tribe of Yehuda, saying, how can I stand by my younger brother Binyamin? Binyamin, generations later, in the form of Esther and Mordechai, say the exact same words, Eich ereh bara'ah asher yimtso es ami. How can I stand idly by and see what's going to happen to my brethren, all of these from the tribe of Yehuda? I can't just say, well, they're from Judah. We're Benjamites. They're Yehuda. It's the exact same phrase that Yehuda says to save Binyamin. Binyamin, years later, says the exact same words in stepping in and putting her life on the line in order to save Yehuda. It's a beautiful parallel in the language that the Megillah points out between what happens, you know, back then and still finding its way throughout Tanakh, weaving its way through. We will leave it with that. There's obviously always more to do, but that's the halfway through the eighth chapter. We'll leave more for other stuff. I'll leave you with one final thought. One final question. Not even a thought. A question for you to ponder as you go through listening to the Megillah. There are three verses which we say out loud. If you have in your Megillah, we say, first verse we say is in the second chapter in my stone Chumash, in the second chapter, verse 5. Ish Yehudi ayah b'Shushan Habirah. There was a Jewish man in Shushan. His name was Mordechai, the son of Yair, son of Shimi, ben Kish, Ishimini, Benjamite. That's the first verse that we say, in which we, in essence, introduce Mordechai. The second verse that we say out loud, it's in bold, in the end of the eighth chapter, verse 15. Mordechai left the king's presence clad in royal apparel of turquoise and white and a large gold crown and a robe of fine linen and purple, and the city of Shushan was cheerful and glad. Which we define Mordechai leaving the palace clad in royal garments at the end of the chapter, which we left off in, after he's been appointed to command of Haman's estate, and he's into the palace, we describe that. And then the third verse we read aloud is the final verse of the Megillah. Very last verse in the 10th chapter, the third pasuk there. For Mordechai the Jew was viceroy to King Achashverosh, a great man among the Jews, found favor with a multitude of his brethren, sought the good of his people, and was concerned for the welfare of all posterity. What is the common thread that runs through the three verses which we say out loud? Mordechai. Mordechai, Mordechai, Mordechai. Mordechai, we introduce Mordechai. We describe Mordechai leaving in the king's robes and royal garments as he leaves. And then we conclude the Megillah with Mordechai being a really good guy. Everybody liked him, and he was a great man. All three verses are Mordechai. Who's missing? Esther. What's the Megillah called? Esther. What's the deal that the three verses that we say are all focused on Mordechai, introducing him, leaving the palace in his royal garments, and then the last verse saying that he was a great man and everybody loved him? Why do we conclude the Megillah with that? Why are we focused on Mordechai and Esther seems to get none of the PR as far as the verses which we as a congregation say aloud? It's all focused on Mordechai. That's something to think about. You can come up with your thoughts after, during the Yontif. I'm happy to hear them. But those are some thoughts on Megillah Esther. I hope it will help enhance your Yontif of Purim. I wish you all a Freilich in Purim, a joyous, joyful and safe Yontif of Purim, a very special time for the Jewish people, and I hope this helped enhance that. Have a great night.